From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
Our friend Noel is on adventures today. They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Quick check-in, Matt, my dear, dear friend over these many years, how are you today?
Well, let me tell you. I'm great. I'm going to get to play some magic later tonight with my buddy Charlie, who lives in upstate New York, and I haven't talked to him in forever, and he finally agreed to to let me be my middle school self again and play some magic with him, and I'm very excited about that. You and I are going to have a game together pretty soon.
That's right. That's right, Matt. Yeah, I've got to go back to the office and pick up one of my favorite gifts I ever received, a deck of magic cards that I suppose are vintage nowadays that you and Tyler made for me many moons ago. I'm quite excited. I'm probably going to scoop those up this weekend and spend some time doing what I did pretty often as a child, playing multiplayer games with myself. Shout out to my one man D&D campaign, just to make sure I know what's going on there.
And for other listeners, just who are interested here, there is a reason that we don't have to talk about on air here that you and Noel and I may have to be at least somewhat close to each other in proximity very soon. I'm thinking about bringing a deck for Noel and forcing him to play a game with us, because I don't know that he's ever played Magic before. We'll see if it works out.
I imagine he'll be delighted. I imagine he'll be delighted. So before we get into today's episode, we do have one on-air correction that a couple of listeners caught. And I just wanted to get this out here because it's important. Specifically, earlier in our episode on Operation Infection with a K, we had a couple of times referred to AIDS as standing for Autoimmunodeficiency Syndrome. That is incorrect. I misspoke there. I think probably I'm the most egregious person with this one. It is actually acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. So that's maybe a small difference in terms of speech, but it's a big difference in terms of what it stands for. And of course, it affects a great many people. If you don't know what we're talking about, please check out Operation Infection, where we do, in fact, uncover a proven conspiracy about HIV and AIDS.
Yes, and specifically some meddling that occurred from Russian actors, let's say.
There we go. When we say Russian actors, we don't mean the stars of screen and stage, right? We mean the no. other actors. Yeah. Today, I'm super excited about this one. Maybe a way to segue into this is the world of games, specifically video games. Now, Matt, you and I have talked at length over more than a decade now that we've been hanging out about video games of all sorts and all stripes. Do you remember Uncharted 3?
I do. Uncharted is a fabulous franchise. The fourth iteration recently was available on PS Plus or PlayStation Plus, if anybody subscribes to that. Hopefully you've played it. Great treasure hunter series. And in the third version, iteration, oh boy, you get into a lost city. Is it Lemuria? Lemuria that is featured in that one, or is it Atlantis?
It is a lost city in the wild desert of the Middle East.
Ah,
a city that was rumored to be home to Jin, a city that was rumored to have untold wealth before it was cursed by the divine. We won't spoil it too much. I believe you can still get at least Uncharted 1 through 3 for free on PlayStation's special Looking Out for You During the Quarantine deal. So I recently replayed this. It's a fantastic game if you're a fan of Indiana Jones. If you're not really a fan of video games, but you do like film and films like Indiana Jones, then think of that almost as, at times, it's more like an interactive movie. You know what I mean? It's a journey. And you, mm-hmm. and you can set the, if you're particularly unmotivated for video game stuff, you can set the levels low enough such that you're just kind of sitting through a movie where you occasionally push buttons. You know, it's like, what was that? Dragon's Lair. That's another old, old one. But you're right, Matt. Lost Cities, they play a big part in Uncharted because Lost Cities play a huge part in human civilization. Like, typically, right, when you hear people talk about ancient lost cities, let's say you're flipping through television or you're flipping through your books and you come across that phrase, lost city, lost civilization. In the modern day, we tend to dismiss that concept, like, right out. You know, places like, you mentioned Lemuria, or it's the Beatles to its Rolling Stone, Atlantis, and so on. These are all kind of thought to be legends, right? And we've done stories on those in the past. I think we got to a pretty surprisingly solid answer on the mystery of Atlantis a while back. But lost cities, lost civilizations, the amazing and disturbing thing about this is they're not that crazy. It turns out our species, as we've said before, we're cartoonishly good at losing things, whether we're talking about car keys, passwords, technologies, cities, entire civilizations. The vast span of human history is this like long running joke about us making stuff and then completely forgetting about it, or at least mostly forgetting about it.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at almost every major civilization space. So a place where a civilization began, you can look, even if it's a city now, let's say in a place like Atlanta, just as an example, there are versions of Atlanta that exist below it that were built on top of, you know, for cities to exist. London is a really good example of that. New York, where there's a version of that place of history that literally went away or went underground, essentially. And you can think about all kinds of things that we've lost over time. You know, entire technologies that have come and gone, you know, even just an entire civilization, a whole place where humanity grew and thrived for a while and just went away for one reason or another.
And sometimes even when we know the location of a lost place, quote unquote lost, even when we know where the ruins are, we still can run into mysteries about why tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people one day just left, right? There are a lot of questions that remain unanswered because history is alive, right? In today's episode, we're exploring a city that some people may not have heard of, but a city that occupies a unique place in folklore and in science here in the modern day. In fact, we call this a lost city, but it may have already been found. And where better to start with this story than with a legend? So here are the facts.
There was once, according to legend, a place known as Iram of the Pillars. It was also known as Ubar, or Ubar for short. We're going to be calling it Ubar in this story. But it was also known as Wubar with a W, Iram, sometimes it was just known as the City of the Pillars. It was this legendary place. It was, or it has been over the course of history, taken as this indisputable fact that there was a true place, a thing that existed by one of these names, generally by people who follow in the faith of Islam. It's explicitly mentioned, by the way, in the Quran, which is a good thing to know for the rest of this story here. The specific phrase, by the way, that's found there is Iram al-Imad. And it's sometimes translated to, you know, maybe a less prestigious sounding phrase called Iram of the Tent Poles. Not so cool. Sounds much better when it's al-Imad. But the English translation of its but we've got it actually here. We've got the English translation of its mention in the Quran.
Right. Yeah. Here's how the explicit mention in the Quran reads in English. Quote, and we're because of the differences between English and Arabic, there's going to be some slippage here. There are some words or pieces of sentence structure that don't quite translate, but we'll give you the gist. Quote, have you not considered how your Lord dealt with Aram, who had lofty pillars, the likes of whom had never been created in the lands, and with Thamud, who carved out the rocks in the valley, and with Pharaoh, owner of the stakes, all of whom oppressed within the lands and increased therein the corruption. So your Lord poured upon them a scourge of punishment. Indeed, your Lord is in observation. That's the words of the prophet, right? In the Quran. That's the story of it's the story of this kind of warning to the reader. It's like, hey, think about what happened to this place. Think about what happened to this guy. And that last line comes off, I think, a little bit mild, where it says, indeed, your Lord is an observation. Maybe a more direct way to say that in American English today would be, you know, watch out, God is watching you, you know?
Yeah, it always feels like somebody's watching me because it has been stated here that he, she, it is indeed. There's another version of this, by the way, where, or I guess of the story of the legend, where Ubar was this center of trade, of wealth, of society. It was located along this really lucrative trade route that existed at the time in which it was a place that was, you know, thriving. And it's where merchants would transport all kinds of things, or this trade route is where merchants would trade all kinds of things, and Ubar was a major stop there. And one of the big things that they traded was frankincense, and this has been mentioned a lot, or at least is a major point of this one version of the legend.
Yeah. Oh, they were balling out. They were making so much money off this frankincense trade, which included myrrh. People are
fans of the three wise men.
Mm-hmm. Then you'll notice that frankincense and myrrh, which are not super big commodities to a lot of people today, were profoundly impressive gifts back then. They were status symbols. They were associated with things that were holy, and so being a part of this trade, the people of Ubar made a lot of money. They obtained many riches, jewels, etc. And this story follows, you know, the kind of Pixar version. Once upon a time, as you said, Matt, Ubar was the center of the trade in frankincense. And every day they got wealthier and wealthier and wealthier until one day a prophet arrives. And this is a pre-Islamic prophet, by the way, in this legend. A prophet arrives and foretells that the city and the entire civilization of Ubar would be destroyed by God as punishment for their wicked, wicked ways. The king, who was not aware that he was to be the last king of Ubar, ignored the prophet. And a short while later, the city disappeared from the historical record. It was buried under the shifting sands of the empty quarter in Arabia, they called it then, but Saudi Arabia, we call it now.
Yeah, it feels maybe at first glance or first listen as a similar parable that has existed in a couple of different holy books and a couple of different societies and kind of historical records, where there's this place that became so wealthy, they just were bored in some ways because they had so much time on their hands, and they started to do the things that idle hands do, which is generally considered, you know, the devil's work or the bad things, the wicked, evil things. And then it gets destroyed because a force of good, in this case, God, comes through and says, no. but if you continue along the legend, even though it was destroyed, if it was real, then it would still exist out there somewhere, right? At least according to legend.
Right. Somewhere out there in the dry ocean of the desert, one may still discover the ruins of ancient Ubar, all the riches within, and possibly all the curses and consequences you would run into for violating the wishes of the divine. And you know, Matt.
Yeah, but mostly all those vases full of that dank frankincense.
Mm-hmm. Dankincense. That'll be the name of the company we start. Dankincense. Yeah, we'll find something for myrrh as well, because myrrh is still very much in the game in this part of the story. But you're right. So the details of the disaster are naturally vague. The idea, you know, at the time this story takes place, or when it's traced to antiquity, usually natural disasters are always seen as happening for some sort of reason. No one is ever saying, hey, we have famine because we couldn't grow crops because of the drought. They say, oh, we are encountering famine because we have crops because of the drought, because God is super PO'd at us, you know, because we didn't make the right sacrifices or didn't propitiate the right prayers at the right time in the calendar, etc. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just the human mind. Because humans have always been, you know, these are still Homo sapien. They're very much like us. They're still trying to categorize and frame and understand the world. So when you hear details about Ubar's demise, you'll hear people say, you know, well, it was God that struck them down. And then you'll hear other people say, well, it was God who struck them down, but God did it this way, right? Through an earthquake, maybe, or through a sandstorm that never stopped. It's kind of like Atlantis, right? That's another example. Or Sodom and Gomorrah.
That's a good example.
Yeah, because it has the wickedness, right? And it's still, you know, it's a story that's common to what they call people of the book, right? Judeo-Christian, Islamic belief systems. But Ubar has a couple of things in its legend that make it different. First, speculation about Ubar has continued, you know, since the writing of the Quran, which really popularized it, because that is a book that is fundamental to many civilizations. And then some other lost city legends, just by contrast, they claim that there are ancient origins to them, but they end up being examples of embellishments, maybe, or outright hoaxes. This is not the case here. I mean, Aram Ubar was popularized in the West in the 30s and really picked up some modern shine and PRTLC in the 1990s. But again, it's been known in the Middle East. The West alone is not the world. It was known in the Middle East since the Quran, since before then. It assumed its more modern interpretation way back during the aggregation and dissemination of the anthology we know of as 1001 Nights, a fantastic book that was composed over centuries during the Islamic Golden Age. We still don't know, to be completely clear, how that book was formed. It's a mystery of its own. But that's not the only reason Ubar is unique.
Yeah, there are some pretty old maps that actually placed a physical location of Ubar on these maps. There's one where it's depicted as Omanum Emporium there. And that's on Ptolemy's lap, Ptolemy, his map of the world. This guy, Claudius Ptolemy, he was born in Greece, lived in Egypt. And this is around 110 to 170 AD. So that's some time ago, let's say. It's also mentioned by several other Islamic commentators throughout the years, the centuries that have existed, as possibly existing in one place or another, and in multiple like versions of it, essentially, of the legend.
Yeah. The primary evidence, which, you know, we're very thankful for, a lot of the primary evidence comes from religious or religious-affiliated text. So there's going to be this ongoing debate about translation, you know? And then about, like you said, Matt, is this literally a city? Is this literally a civilization? Is this a metaphor, you know? Is this like a larger version of all those stories that even today kids hear, like, don't do act A, B, or C, or else you'll have consequence X, Y, or Z. What if it wasn't a city at all? What if it was a region instead? So instead of, whenever the U.S. falls and you fast forward a couple millennia or something, what if no one remembers the city of Atlanta and they talk about the lost city of Georgia? It's located somewhere on this continent. Everybody's got weird ideas about it.
It would be the lost city of coming, I think.
There we go. That stuff happens all the time. And then the name would get distorted and telephoned, and it would be like Kumink or Kumang or something like that. Yeah, that happens constantly, constantly. So maybe it wasn't even a region. Maybe it was not geographical. Maybe it was a name for a people. Which also happens pretty often, right? Because we know that in ancient times, and even now, groups of people, communities, and tribes, the names that outsiders use refer to the place where those people are found, right? And the places where they live get named after them. Israelites, Israel, you know what I mean? Like, especially the Middle East is full of this stuff. So Ubar has long been associated with a group of people called the Ud, spelled like apostrophe A-D, but pronounced more like Ud. And back in the 11th century, there was a commentator named Nashwan bin Said Himyari, who said, quote, "Ubar is the name of the land which belonged to Ud in the eastern part of Yemen. Today it's an untrodden desert. Owing to the dying up of its water, there are to be found in it great buildings which the wind has smothered in sand." He doesn't really mention God. He just mentions these people built some stuff and they're no longer in the game.
How intriguing is that, though? I mean, again, like, bring back Indiana Jones, just some of these concepts that at least I, as a child and then growing up, were so fascinating of, you know, finding, being able to one day maybe chase down some historical place like this, or discovering a lost place, a lost people that existed somewhere. It's just such fuel for the imagination. And, you know, it really just depends on where you look, who you ask, who you just want to believe, I guess, on how you think about Ubar, where it could be, what it could be, who the actual people were, and what occurred there. And it also depends on your faith, honestly, depending on, you know, the books you grew up with as the important pillars of your faith and your understanding of the world. But it's really cool that this place has all of this potential built within it.
You know, you may have grown up most familiar with that description in the Quran. You may have been a fan of T.E. Lawrence, the famous and very strange explorer and military officer. He's the one who, I think, popularized calling it the Atlantis of the Sands. But the most important thing about the Atlantis of the Sands is that we're pretty sure someone found it. What are we talking about? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy. Matt, we gotta talk about these searches. You know, people are out here changing the world, man. One time I fell asleep trying to put on a pair of pants. Like, this is a great examination of human ingenuity, if nothing else.
The other day I fell asleep. I stuck my head into my son's rocket ship tent. And I was playing with him really actively, and I totally passed out right there. So I feel you, Ben. Just saying, maybe we should stop falling asleep on our various jobs, such as pants putting on. but other people have not been sitting around getting drowsy. They've been out there searching the desert, for stuff, which is really, really cool. There are several individuals who believe they have uncovered this place that was mentioned in the Quran. And, you know, there's debate on who's right, who actually found it. And we're going to go through all of that stuff right now. But you really can find people who have claimed at least to have found this legendary place, Ubar or Iram, that was mentioned in the Quran, that specific version of it. And they think they found it in the Middle East, in places from Oman to Yemen, to Jordan, places in Jordan, the place called the Wadi Rum, the Wadi Rum. This is, the infamous Rub, what is this, Ben? I don't know this. The infamous Rub al-Khali?
Yeah, that's right. The Rub al-Khali, the empty quarter. We should note that, as far as we know, neither of us are Arabic speakers, unless we had a wild weekend and forgot about it. The empty quarter is a vast stretch of immensely inhospitable land that we'll talk about in a little bit. But I noticed, Matt, you pointed out Wadi Rum. Let's talk about this a little bit. So it's in Jordan. Its name translates, or it's called the Valley of the Moon. And this looks otherworldly. It's a desert landscape. Picture a lot of flat, sandy valley beds. Wadi is Arabic for valley, and they're bordered by these enormous red sandstone cliffs. It's the largest valley in Jordan, and it also carries the signs of ancient human occupation. We've got inscriptions, petroglyphs, ruins of temples, graffiti, stuff that dates back as far as 12,000 years. People have been there for a long, long time.
Yeah, and it's one of those places that the glory of, you know, the natural surroundings and this, you know, the somewhat starkness of it as well, wasn't really known by the West until some guy walked through there who happened to be British. A man named T.E. Lawrence, he was a British military officer. He really brought it to the West's attention, who was passing through there during the Arab Revolt, which occurred between 1916 and 1918. And he, you know, was moved by the experience of going through that area. And he wrote a book about his experience called Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
And then we get into a weird circumstance here, a little bit of a PR move, because there's a formation at Wadi Rum called the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. That's what it's called today. It's great for tourism. That's not its original name. Its original name was like Jabal al-Mamzar, the Mountain of the Plague. And so,
ooh, yeah, nobody wants to visit the Mountain of the Plague.
I mean, I'm down, but, you know, I'm sure there's another Mountain of a Plague somewhere. So this was renamed, even though the formation that's mentioned has nothing to do with the seven pillars actually mentioned in Lawrence's book, even in like later editions. It is all about tourism there. It is a hugely popular tourist destination, and it's, of course, an enormously important site of human civilization. It's also something that you, fellow conspiracy realists, have probably seen before. You just didn't know it. You might have thought it was planet Mars in The Martian. You might have thought it was any number of backdrops for films set in the Middle East or on our red neighbor, just a planet away. It's also in some famous ones.
Oh, yeah. There's a Star Wars movie, Rogue One, that used it. The Transformers Revenge of the Fallen featured this. And my favorite one, even though it wasn't my favorite movie, but my favorite version of it, is seen in Prometheus. I really liked the way it was treated there, at least on camera.
Mm, yeah. Also, of course, it's in the Aladdin reboot, the live action.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
I never asked your, you know, I forgot to ask your opinion on that. I know that we both loved that film growing up, and I still think it holds up. But what did you see the remake?
Hot take. I suffered through it until Will Smith's like 10th line, and then I turned it off. Or I didn't turn it off. My son and my wife continued to watch a little bit, but I left the room. I couldn't handle it.
In silent protest?
No, it wasn't very silent. It was definitely like, ugh, and then left.
Yeah, Robin Williams left some big shoes to fill, and I don't think it's... I mean, it's funny because I really enjoyed all the other actors in there. I thought they nailed it. And for some reason, again, this is just one person's opinion. We'll have to get Paul's about this off air too. It just felt like they were trying to make it Will Smith plays Will Smith as a genie. I mean, to be fair, that's what Robin Williams was doing too. I liked the earlier songs.
Yeah, me too. It's a real Mountain of the Plague, Seven Pillars of Wisdom scenario, you know? The translation just, or the change up just didn't play as, in this case, didn't play as well.
Yeah, true. But again, visually, you know, there's stunning scenes in there. And again, I think the vast majority of the actors nailed it, so I don't want to be unfair. I think I figured out how I like my culturally appropriated idea of Jin in Disney films, because it's not like the Robin Williams genie is in any way accurate to begin with.
But if you're gonna make a scary version, like the scariest version of a Jin, which is the one that this genie is supposed to inhabit, and you're gonna make him like a family friendly G version, then you know, go all the way with it. Just make him super happy and transforming into all kinds of different Western characters from pop culture.
That's right. So I'm going to watch that later, as long as we don't get disappeared. I think we can close the book, though, on the Wadi Rum. It's definitely an historically significant site, but it is probably not the Atlantis of the Sands, as T.E. Lawrence called it. It's probably not a lost city. There are some ancient temples there, but the fact is there's so much tourism there now that if there were an ancient empire or gigantic city, it would have been found. I mean, people travel from around the world to visit and film there.
I would say that just going with the name, the Mountain of the Plague, may make you think, if you put yourself in the shoes of maybe someone exploring the area who isn't fully familiar with it, may make you think that, well, you know, this place was named the Mountain of the Plague. Perhaps there was something that happened here a long time ago that we don't fully understand. I can imagine that scenario, or at least that thought process.
Totally. Totally. And I agree. I mean, you know, when you get to a place that's had human beings for that long, I'm sure there were several plagues. You know what I mean? I don't think somebody probably didn't make that name up for fun. They didn't think it was cool. They remembered when people died of the plague in the area, and they were like, don't even get to where you can friggin' see that mountain, bro. It's messed up.
Yeah.
I could totally see that. History is filled with ghosts.
We're going to shoot all our movies there.
And now we shoot movies there. Now we shoot movies there. So there are also a lot of films shot around the area of the empty quarter, the Rubak Kali. If you're going just off the oral traditions and the legends, it makes a lot of sense to think that a city might have been there and vanished, because it feels like the easiest place for human beings to vanish. It's vast. It's a sand desert. It covers most of the southern third of the Arabian Peninsula, and it is huge. It's like 250,000 square miles. That means it goes across Saudi Arabia, goes across the United Arab Emirates, goes across Oman, Yemen, and today it's a rough neighborhood for humans. It's actually rougher for humans now than it was in ancient times, and even then it was no walk in the park. The precipitation is like maybe 1.4 inches on a good year. The temperatures can reach as high as 51 degrees Celsius for everyone in
the... Oh, 51? That's not bad.
Right. For everyone in the States, that's 124 degrees Fahrenheit. And it gets cold AF at night. It's like one of those places in the world where, if you look at it objectively, are humans supposed to be here? Are we really? Do we need to go out here? You know, like, I don't know, man. I really don't know.
Well, maybe not anymore, but back before the intense desertification that's been occurring out there, and, you know, on a continual level and increasing, it was a pretty cool place to be, a good place to at least travel through in a lot of the areas of it, because guess what they did? They traded things in caravans like frankincense.
And myrrh.
And myrrh.
I don't know why it feels like there's a Simon and Garfunkel thing going on with frankincense and myrrh. Or maybe it's like if we were selling a box of frankincense, it would say like frankincense now with myrrh.
And, dude, no, I'll tell you a better one.
Yeah.
It's Hall and Oats.
Oh, wow.
Because it feels so healthy. It should, or something like extra that you don't need. You just want the Hall.
So, yes, I get it. You know, it's like people will eat the oats, but yeah, we're here for the Halls. That makes a lot of sense. Like, so maybe that's it. But your point is right. Desertification, the process of becoming more desert-like, has increased over time to the present level today. Before then, it was still very much a wasteland. But caravans, often on camelback, would be able to traverse established routes here to get that sweet, sweet frankincense and myrrh, and move it to more densely populated areas where it would fetch a great premium, as much as for its rarity as for its smell. And this trade occurred till around an estimated like 300 AD. People were doing this, but the problem with the empty quarter is the same thing that made people think that's where Aram could be or Ubar could be. It's that it is huge. In the days before satellite observation, it would be really difficult for early explorers, especially, as you said, the British guys, the aristos who are walking in and quote-unquote discovering all this stuff, it would be really tough for them to systematically comb the desert without dying of thirst, starvation when they got lost. Now, the native people, the Bedouin, knew their way around, right? But
yeah, exactly. Especially if you're trying to do it, you know, Spaceballs style and combing the desert, like... That'd be a rough gig.
It's a rough gig. It takes a lot of people and a lot of time. So, yeah, there could be an ancient oasis in the area. We know there are oases all around the edges of the empty quarter. That's what defines the empty quarter. It's the empty part. And the stuff around the edges has stuff there. But if you were going to find something, if you're going to find an ancient city, where would you start looking? How would you find it? This leads us to the various attempts to discover it. So we've nailed down that it's probably not in the empty quarter, at least so far as we know. It's unlikely that it would be. And then it's probably not in Wadi Rum in Jordan. But we got a bunch of pretty moneyed British explorers who have no other goals other than to make some money off the native cultures and later brag to their friends at the Royal Geographic Society. And they were all about this.
And we also have satellite technology now and other, you know, advanced technology. So that's a bit of a spoiler. And we'll tell you about the potential discovery after a word from our sponsor.
We're back. So let's start in 1930. There is an explorer named Bertram Thomas. Bertram Thomas has the goal of being the first European, in his opinion, to officially cross the sands. of the empty quarter. He's at the southern edge of the area. And I just say in his opinion, because I take issue with the idea of him being the first person ever from Europe to do that, because this is 1930 and there was a lot of stuff that happened before he got this idea. Anyway, so he starts this journey and he's ready, you know, he's got his camels, he's got his entourage and stuff, people who are native to the land, and some members of his Bedouin entourage tell him about the story of this lost city. And he says, all right, well, I'm going to find that. That's going to be something I can brag to the rest of my lads about back home. He didn't find it, but he did tell T.E. Lawrence about it. T.E. Lawrence is the guy who popularized the phrase, the Atlantis of the Sands. He didn't just tell him about it. He said, right, old chap, and he marked a map for Lawrence with the supposed location. Lawrence, again, very weird dude. I don't want to kink shame anyone. I don't want to yuck anyone's yum, as Chuck would say. But Lawrence was a smart dude. And he immediately knew what we had just talked about, the vast difficulties of finding this needle of civilization in this haystack of the wild. So we said, you know, the only way we're going to be able to find this is if we somehow get in the air. We search by like airship, by a blimp. But he never followed through with it. You know, again, it's 1930s, 1940s. A lot of stuff's going down in the Middle East and Europe. But these statements that he made and that other explorers made cemented the idea of this lost Arab city in the Western zeitgeist. So people were obsessed with it.
Yeah, and remember, T.E. Lawrence that we spoke about earlier is the Seven Pillars of Wisdom guy in the Wadi Rum that we talked about. Same dude, same British military officer who tended to write a lot about these kinds of things. So that's why it makes sense that it kind of expanded out there in the minds of people in the West. But it didn't stop there, everybody. Let's jump forward 16 years to 1946 and to another English explorer, British fellow named Wilfred Thesiger. Actually, maybe it's Wilfred Thesiger. I don't know how to say it. Wow, it's English. Thesiger?
I would go with Thesiger. Maybe put a little put a little British polish on it. I think you nailed it with Thesiger.
It could be the Seeger.
We'll call
Wilfred Thesiger. So he's hanging out in a place called Shisir. It's in southern Oman. He's hanging out by this well that's over there, just in an area, an undefined area. And he notes that he's seeing some kinds of crude stone, some kind of ruins maybe from a fort. He's seeing them on this rocky eminence. That's a quote there about the eminence. And some of the things that he finds there, let's call them shards. Some of the things he finds in the area may be, in his opinion, they may be early Islamic. And, you know, he tells the Royal Geographic Society this, but nothing, you know, official comes out of it. There's no, like, exploration in the moment because of this guy Wilfred Thesiger's experience.
But people remember, right? People, mm-hmm. people are keeping note. Just 2 years later, 1948, a party of Bedouins and oil company employees are traveling there. They're surveying Dhofar province. This is, of course, part of Western Europe's state-sponsored push to divide up the territories for resource acquisition, right? And they first see this place, Shisir, or also called Ash-Shisir. They're approaching it from the south, and the first thing they see is this white cliff in the distance. As they get closer, they say, hey, this cliff is not just a cliff, it's man-made. It's the wall of a ruined fort, and it's built above this large cave. And there's an entrance to this cave, but it's obscured by a sand dune. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I'm picturing like this crazy Indiana Jones music in my head. They found the fort had been built from the same white rock as that cliff, and this gave them, this to them, seemed to indicate that this whole thing was a single structure. One of the geologists said, you know, there are no houses or tents or people here. There's just this tumble-down ruin in this pre-Islamic fort. Womp womp. Because the geologists didn't have modern satellites. God, we're throwing so many spoilers in this. They didn't have archaeological equipment. They were unimpressed by the ruin. They were like, there's not even oil here, bro. In fact, their guides and them, they all referred to it as, quote, difficult water, because it was the only watering hole for miles and miles and miles around, and they had to spend 3 days trying to get water from this dying well for their camels. So it was like they stopped in a place because it had one thing that they needed. They barely had that. They wrote down a one-star review of it in their Yelp travel journal, and then they dipped out. But all of those things that happened were still on a record. Fast forward to the 80s and 1990s.
Yeah, that's right. Zero Michelin stars for Chasseur before that. Now, jumped to 1991, same area. Just before we get into this, there is a fantastic New York Times old school article from 92, I think, that was written about this that we recommend you go check out. The title of it is On the Trail from the Sky, Roads Point to a Lost City. So if before we talk about it, if you want to read it, hey, it's good stuff in there. So there's a filmmaker from Los Angeles named Nicholas Clapp. Really, really cool spelling, by the way. I don't know if he spells it that way because of a Screenwriters Guild thing, but C-L-A-P-P is his last name. You know, he's one of those guys, it's the 90s. This guy's grown up with a fascination of, you know, the romantic mystery that exists out there in ancient, you know, Arabia and the sands, as well as, you know, this the concept of these huge caravanning frankincense trade that's occurring, right? And he goes out to that same area, Chasseur, and really what he wants to do is use that new technology that has been developed since people have been looking at this place. And he wants to, you know, he really just wants to discover this place, right? And he ends up finding things that have never been found out there before.
Yeah, so he assembles this this crew of specialists, as you said, to investigate. They include financial backers. They also include scientists from JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratories. And then he also gets with Randolph Fiennes, who, yes, is related to the actor Ralph Fiennes, who plays Voldemort. I thought you would enjoy that, Paul. He also plays the antagonist in Red Dragon, in the Silence of the Lambs franchise. Anyhow, he has his relative, Randolph Fiennes. He's a well-to-do European, and he is also affiliated with the Sultan of Oman. So he's kind of their fixer on the ground. So they get together, and they're reviewing this footage from these satellites. And again, this is the very early days of this. This is before, you know, widespread use of a lot of other technologies that people have today. But they see things that you wouldn't see if you're walking on the ground. One of the most important things they find is a network of ancient camel tracks, caravan routes that seem to converge on a couple of different places. One of them is Ash-Shishur in Oman. And this, like, they, you know, they do all the ground, they do all the mental legwork they can before they go there because it's a bit of a journey. So their first ground exploration takes place in 1991. They learn so much stuff, and that's where we get to that breathless, like, old-school NYT headline, On the Trail from the Sky, Road Points to a Lost City. And then it begins with this beautiful quotation. It's the first sentence is just solid gold. Matt, do you have maybe, like, a – I almost hate to ask. Do you have a transatlantic voice for this one?
Yeah, okay, I'll do it.
Guided by ancient maps and sharp-eyed surveys from space, archaeologists and explorers have discovered a lost city deep in the sands of Arabia. They are virtually sure it is Ubar, the fabled entrepot of the rich frankincense trade thousands of years ago. And, it continues...
Yes, and... There doesn't seem to be much question that we have discovered Omanum Emporium, says Dr. Joris Zaranis, the expedition's chief archaeologist. The site, he says, is very rich, no doubt about it. So is this the real Ubar? Under the direction of Dr. Zaranis, the team starts digging. They excavate the walls and towers of this fortress. They're working fast. They find a site that dates back more than 2,000 years. How can they work that fast? Archaeological digs are a huge issue in the Middle East, and because there are so many ancient civilizations, and because there are so many modern civilizations at war over history right now, they're able to do this, again, because Ranulf Fiennes is buddy-buddy with the Sultan. What he says goes. So Dr. Zaranis doesn't just find this ancient site. He also... is able to trace its demise a little bit. And he says, look, the site has this huge sinkhole kind of bisecting it, if you look at the pictures. And he says it fell sometime between AD 300 and AD 500. And if you recall, earlier at the top of the show, we said AD 300 is about when the frankincense trade is suspected to have declined.
Interesting, right? And, when you keep thinking about it in this way, if there was some kind of cataclysm or a huge earthquake or a big sinkhole that formed and sucked in everything pretty quickly over the course of, even a couple years, you can imagine how perhaps that would have been blamed on an act of God of some sort.
And he says specifically, it's like, look, there was fossil water here. Fossil water is something we talked about a little bit in our work on Libya years ago. Fossil water is a non-renewable source of potable or drinkable water. And so it's kind of how this oasis was working. But it was also built over limestone. And so as more and more people and animals and agriculture, because they had irrigation schemes, more and more things started draining more and more water. It probably contributed to an earthquake, or maybe it was the primary cause of this collapse. So the thing fell. The center could not hold. However, Dr. Zaranis himself is quick to point out that there might be a chicken and egg thing. Because if the frankincense trade was still, doing gangbusters, then there would have been enough finance, right? There would have been enough political will to rebuild this lost place. And that all depends on whether our modern idea of Ubar existed at all. Because, you see, Doc Z is not convinced.
He's not. And it also depends on whether or not they could actually get water if that fossil water was actually the reason that caused the collapse. But let's talk about Dr. Zaranis and why he was unsure, because there was this great interview with him from Nova. If you haven't watched a lot of Nova and you're listening to this, I highly recommend you do. It's really great. They're not a sponsor, but I very much enjoy the programming with the stuff they put out there. But they were speaking with him about Ubar, and we've got a quote from him. He says, "There's a lot of confusion about that word," talking about Ubar. "If you look at the classical texts and the Arab historical sources, Ubar refers to a region and a group of people, not to a specific town. People always overlook that. It's very clear on Ptolemy's 2nd century map of the area. It says in big letters, La Bitarite, and in his text that accompanies the maps, he's very clear about that. It was only the late medieval version of the 1000 and One Knights in the 14th and 15th centuries that romanticized Ubar and turned it into a city rather than a region or a people."
Instead, he says, Shisir, the site they found, is one of maybe three or four major trade and civilization centers of the Ubarite at a time when this tribal group, the Uberites, thrived along the edges of the empty quarter. So he's saying that they didn't discover the mythical city, but in a way that they discovered something more important. They discovered the truth that inspired the myth. We have to remember that when people saw this city, they were seeing it after 7-8 days journey through utter desolation, no food, no water. We also have to understand that when they saw, like when you see it now, you can see photographs of the ruins today, along with artist depictions of how the actual fortress looked at its time, right? And the fortress itself, especially after you've heard all these myths, it looks a little underwhelming, honestly. But you have to consider that many of the people who were living there, who were populating it, even on a permanent basis, they weren't living in this relatively small fortress. They were living outside around it. They were living in large tents that you could open up to catch a breeze and things like that. They would probably only be in the fortress if there were some sort of siege or attack. It reminds me, like, it doesn't look like a shining city of pillars in the pictures of the ruins or even in the artistic depictions. But, you know, then again, for anyone who's seen the Tower of London, this stuff doesn't look like a skyscraper, right? We have very different definitions of towers hundreds of years ago. You know what I mean? Anything over three floors, that's a tower.
Oh, absolutely. I really like your point there of just to reach that area, no matter for what reason you're traveling through or, you know, to get there, you would have been on a perilous journey. This is a weird kind of way to think about it, but you shot a picture into my head, Ben, of a day that I worked a full day, like let's say 8-9 hours, then immediately after that shot a film festival 48 hours thing immediately following a full day of work. And I hadn't eaten food in like 30 hours or something. And somebody suggested getting Popeyes. I didn't know what that was. I tried it for the first time with my wife, and it was the best piece of chicken I had ever eaten in my life. Now, is that because it was actually the best piece of chicken, or is it because I was starved or I felt starving and, you know, was so hungry that this just became a prized thing in that moment? I wonder if that experience is correct. And it's a really great point, Ben.
You're making a really great point too. And not to date you there, Matt, but that is before the famous chicken sandwich. That was just like, you got a two or a three piece, right? With a biscuit.
It's true.
Yeah, I stand by Popeyes. This is not an advertisement for Popeyes, but I think, at least here in Atlanta, one thing we love about Popeyes is you can tell how good the chicken's going to be by like how abrasive the people who work there are. Probably some of the best Popeyes here in our neck of the global woods is right down the street from our office, where famously, I don't know about you, I went there for lunch one day. I was just trying to pick up something to eat. I was in a hurry. And when I pulled up at the drive-thru, the person on the other end said, "What?"
Yeah. It's a one-to-one ratio on how good the chicken is going to be and how much grief you get for ordering. Yeah.
But I think you make a really great point about the psychology of people there, because, you know, you are going into a place that, A, looked much more impressive when it was in its glory days before it collapsed. Back when there were hundreds of people there, there was irrigation and stuff, it looked much better and people were much more appreciative because some of them probably came pretty close to dying while they were risking their lives and their fortunes in the frankincense trade. So there really, was there an Ubar of myth? Probably not. Was there a real place upon which Ubar is based? Yes, and we probably found it. This is a real life case of a lost city that was found, like the lost city of Troy. And, you know, if it looks disappointing and the Tower of London example is maybe a little disappointing too, let's be further disappointing. The pyramids used to look way better. Those things used to be painted. Like, you know, I wish people would point that out more. They used to be more colorful. Anyway, this fortress was surrounded by smaller villages that stretched out as far as 6 miles. It was It's an example kind of a, what's called a caravanserai, that become, you know, a roadhouse, a stop on the road, you know, like the same kind of thing that made Samarkand in Uzbekistan a huge global force, regional force. It was, it's like, imagine if the only gas station for hundreds and hundreds of miles became a town. That's another way to look at it. And I don't think that's pejorative or dismissive at all. It's amazing. So maybe in conclusion, maybe the game of telephone strikes again. I know that's disappointing to some people, but it's amazing to me. I love it. And you know what it makes me think, Matt? I don't know about you. It makes me wonder, what else is out there? There's got to be more.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Just because we found this one doesn't mean other stuff isn't out there. We haven't fully LIDAR'd that desert yet. At least I'm pretty sure we haven't, because it would take a lot of LIDAR to go through that desert. But I'm just telling you, like, my excitement for possibilities out there in the shifting sands, it remains peaked, and it will stay that way for a good time.
Yeah, and it'll probably have to stay a sense of excitement and anticipation for a while, because, you know, so much of that part of the world is embroiled in political instability. There are war zones, you know, in seats of ancient human civilization, and we're really,
they're being destroyed.
Right, and we're really faced with we're faced with a powerful dilemma, which is, you know, will our species be able to come together and save its past, its collective past? Make no mistake, you know, the ancient history of the Middle East, if you're listening to this, it is part of your history too. You trace yourself back far enough, it's part of your history somehow. So it's our collective responsibility to try to keep it around for those who come after. We're just, as we said in the very, very beginning, we're very, very good at losing things. Let's hope we get a little bit better at rediscovering and preserving them. Let us know what you think about today's episode. We've run a little long, but we hope you enjoyed it. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. We're Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook and Twitter. We're Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. But personally, if you're a Facebook person, do check out our Facebook page. Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You can meet some of the best mods in the business, and the best part of this show, your fellow listeners.
Yes, please do, if you are a Facebook user. If you're not and you have a cellular phone or a mobile phone or a landline, you can call the number 1-833-STD-WYTK, and you can leave us a message that Ben and I will certainly hear. Noel likely will as well. Paul refuses to listen to your messages on account of principle that his ears can only be used for a certain number of hours every day, and he's generally producing or having to listen to us. But we do look forward to hearing from you, your thoughts on this episode or on future episodes, or just chatting with us, or, you know, talking to us about your favorite Magic the Gathering cards, or how Thomas Middleditch on the new special talks about it in episode 2 a lot. And it made me smile just all day long thinking about Thomas Middleditch playing Magic the Gathering.
On their improv special?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. No, do check that out. And also, if none of that quite bags your badgers, or if you are more comfortable with a little bit more anonymity, please remember, you can always contact us to talk about lost civilizations, Magic the Gathering, Harry Potter, Popeye's Chicken, whatever crosses your mind. We would love to hear from you, and we have an easy way for you to do it. It'll be on as long as we have this show around. It's our good old-fashioned email address. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.